Andrew Bonner ministered in the Free Church at Finiston in Glasgow, 1856 through 1892. But he looked into the Psalm 3 and he said of this third Psalm, it is a Psalm that may be found as suitable and needful in the latter days as when David wrote it. And then he notes, when waves of sorrow and calamity are dashing over the ship of the church, it may borrow from this psalm that ground of hope which long ago Jonah borrowed from it in his strange trial. Salvation is of the Lord. There's no doubt we have arrived at the kind of day that Andrew Bonner back then was talking about. These are, no matter how we view them, the latter days. And it's painfully obvious that this is a time when the waves of trouble, the waves of sorrow and calamity are dashing over the ship of the church. When sin and scandal, when disappointment and disaster are never far away. Now, if this psalm, Psalm 3, speaks to those kind of circumstances, then I put it to you and to me tonight, it's a good one for us to consider. Look at the title. And even in the title of the psalm, a flood of light comes right over its contents. It's a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. It's clearly a mourning hymn if you look at verse 5. David testifies here, I laid me down and slept. I awaked, for the Lord sustained me. I came through the night into the brightness of the dawn in the morning, and on awaking here from a good night's sleep, he puts down these words. Now we tuned into 2 Samuel. Chapter 15. We could have read right through 16 and 17 as well, but for sake of time, we didn't do that. But the psalm ties into that particular event. Whenever Absalom had come down in rebellion against his father David, taken over the hearts of the men of Israel, got them to rally to his standard and his banner, and they were going down to Jerusalem to take over the throne. But just in time, David and his little band escape out over the Jordan, up over Olivet, and there they're away into the wilderness, looking for the caves and the dens of the rock to provide them with the shelter and protection they needed. Now, the psalm here, Psalm 3, I'm sure it wasn't written the morning after that hasty flight from Jerusalem just the night before. That morning was spent, we're told in 2 Samuel 17, verse 15 to 22, the morning spent in getting David's little company safely across the river. So the earliest the psalm could have been written would have been the following morning after a refreshing night's sleep. We're with David now, the fugitive king. And he's on the high road to Mahanaim, where we meet old Barzillai, who comes laden down with goods and provision for the fleeing king, and hands him a bounty that was fit for a king. This is the first song in the Hebrew hymn book that is actually entitled a psalm. The word comes from the Hebrew mizmor, which has to do with a pruning or a cutting off of superfluous twigs. And those who are gardeners will know what that's going to look at whenever the business is done. You've pruned it. It's virtually unrecognizable now from when you started. It's down to the bare essentials for survival and then progress at the next sprouting season. But hear this word, mizmor. A psalm. Reading through this third psalm, you'll see how appropriate the word is. For here's a psalm that is a song, and it's made up of short, sharp, simple sentences. It is pruned down to the bare essentials. And it's very direct language that David is using here. Whenever you're called upon to make a special speech, maybe it's some commemorative event, or the passing out at a university, or whatever it might be, people that are asked to do that kind of thing, they will maybe spend days, hours certainly, on preparing that speech and fill it with flowery phrases and all the rest of it, and they'll be trying to appeal to the audience, and if they think there are distinguished guests within the audience, and I'm sure the events mentioned would have those kind of guests, then they'll be tailoring their language to suitably impress. You'll do that when you're reasonably relaxed on this celebratory occasion. But when a man's in trouble, and when his back is against the wall, and when time is at a premium, he will not waste time with fine words and with nicely honed expressions. He will get right to the point. An old writer has said, "Let us learn from this, that in the times of sore trouble, men will not fetch a compass and use fine words in prayer, but will offer a prayer which is pruned of all luxuriance of wordy speeches." David finds himself in the depths of trouble. And so in this psalm, he's using appropriate language. He's pruning away all the flowery, leafy things, and he gets right to the point. One word that does need comment, because we're early in the book of the Psalms here, is the word Selah. Well, that pops up quite a few times, does it not, through the book of Psalms. You'll find it 3 times inserted into this particular 3rd Psalm. It is a common word. You'll find it 73 times in all as you work your way through the Psalms. And you'll find it in the Bible only once, outside of the book of the Psalms. You'll find it in the prophecy of Habakkuk and the chapter 3. And there's an argument for saying that that chapter 3 in the book of Habakkuk, that prophecy, is really like a psalm that's inserted there by the prophet under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit in the middle of the problem for which he is looking a solution. It's generally accepted the word Selah has something to do with music. And that's why the word doesn't pop up in the Old Testament prophecies. They were all spoken, announced, declared, not sung. Selah means basically to lift up. And so in the music, it acts like a kind of crescendo mark. The music is building to a peak here. There's been soft accompaniment up until this point, and then David puts in this expressive note for the use of the musicians. Selah, sound it out. Pull out all the stops, we might say. There's a crescendo of music to draw attention to that sentence that is being sung. It's a musical punctuation mark. Another explanation is that the word means, "There, what do you think of that? Pause and ponder what has just been said. Put it in italics. Get it in capital letters. Put in the emphasis there. Selah." Look at how David uses the word in the psalm here. Verse 2, for example, "There is no help for him in God. Selah." Pause. Pregnant pause. What do you think of that? What can we say to that cry that is made against us here? Verse 4, "I cried unto the Lord, and he heard me out of his holy hill." That's something to be really emphasizing, underlining. Rising to a crescendo, "I prayed, God heard my prayer." Ah, what do you think of that? Verse 8. And here's another very necessary Selah. Salvation is of the Lord. Selah. Pause and ponder. What do you think of that? Wherever it's inserted, it's an expressive little word emphasizing the words that are being sung or being spoken. Doesn't always happen this way, but in this particular psalm, the 3 Selahs divide the psalm very conveniently for us. So in verse 1 and verse 2, we have David's trial. Lord, how are they increased that trouble me? Many are they that rise up against me. Verse 2, many there be which say of my soul, there is no help for human God. Selah. Picture the scene. David is in full flight from Jerusalem. That favorite son of his, Absalom, on whom he conferred so much love, is now plotting his own father's execution. David has endured a dreadful 24 hours, but now he's had a good night's rest, and that spiritual buoyancy has reasserted itself in his mind and in his soul. And he looks round at those faithful friends who were with him, companions in need, men on whom he can rely upon. They have been with him on previous tramps over the hills of Judah in those far-off outlaw days under the days of King Saul. And David can see Joab, his commander-in-chief. If there's to be a fight, David's got to be thinking, thank God for men like Joab, I'm glad he's on my side. There's Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, a valiant man, the son of a valiant man as well. Courage was flowing like quicksilver through Benaiah's veins, and David felt a special bond and kinship to him. In their youth, both of them, they had each by himself slain a lion. Thank God, he must have been saying, for Benaiah. In this band of men loyal to me here. And then there's Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, the brother of Joab. Both Joab and Abishai were cousins of David. Abishai had once killed 300 men with a spear in hand-to-hand conduct. And so we have David here looking around upon one face to another face, those mighty men, those noble 30. Only one was missing. Uriah the Hittite. He was dead. And now David is reaping what he had been sowing in that terrible affair. But David had slept well, despite the troubles mounting around him. A night in the hills underneath those stars had brought back memories of the shepherd days and of those fugitive years when Saul was hunting him, as David said, like a partridge from hill to hill. And the sentry up there in the ridge, he had his eye peeled towards Gilead, the direction from which the attack was going to come from Absalom. But David, encouraging himself in the Lord, he grabs his pen and he begins to jot down those thoughts that are flooding into his mind. Maybe Joab yawns, sits up, throws a fierce glare around the camp to make sure that guard is awake and alert and on their toes, and then he glances over at the king, and there's David sitting, propped up by his bedroll, writing away as though he were safe in his study at home. What's he doing now? Wonders Joab. He sees a smile on the face of the king. He silently hears a word or two coming from David's direction as David is finishing with a flourish. And he puts in another selah, a point of emphasis, and he puts it over. Take that to the chief musician. Joab's jaw, as mine would have dropped. This fugitive king, writing a hymn with Absalom's forces mustering by the thousand only a few hills away. Just then I picture David glancing up and catching Joab's eye and his bewildered look. David's smile broadens. Hear, Joab, listen to this. Lord, high are they increased that trouble me. And he reads to Joab the stanzas of what has now been handed down to us as the third psalm. And he ends it by saying, on this note of confidence, salvation is of the Lord. I can picture that scene. But see how David refers to the multiplicity of his foes in Psalm 3 in verse 1. Lord, how are they increased that trouble me? Many are they that rise up against me. David had failed to win over the youth of the nation. The older people in the land, they remembered all that David had done for them. They were about in the days when he had come with the head of Goliath, and they had cheered him on. Saul has slain his thousands, but David has 10,000s. They were totally behind him. But the young people, clever and charming and handsome, Absalom, had taken their hearts. And the army would have been made up, no doubt, as most armies are, of the vigorous youth of the nation. And they had fallen in behind Absalom. He was her choice. So David was aware of the multiplicity of his foes, as we read in 2 Samuel 15 and 12. And the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. Multiplicity of foes, then the malignity. The malignity of his foes in verse 2. Many there be which say of my soul, there is no help for him in God. Maybe David had one man in mind when he wrote that. Shimei had appeared on a hillside as David is fleeing, 2 Samuel 16, verse 5 to 8. He was a real reptile out of the house of Saul, that Shimei, and he had cursed David as David was running from the city, crossing over the river Kidron, and hurrying round the Mount of Olives. In Shimei's curse boiled down to this: no help for him in God. And the word help can be rendered salvation. So David's enemies are really saying here, there is no salvation for him. No way out. His case is hopeless. God can do nothing to save him. David knew that was a lie. No salvation in God for me. And he wrote that into the psalm. And then he stamps Selah right after that. There, what do you think of that? Ponder over that one. No salvation in God? Nobody to get me out of this mess? Nobody to wash away my sin? Nobody to clothe me with his righteousness? No one to present me faultless before the throne of God in heaven? No blood, no altar, no sacrifice, no great high priest, no Christ, no Calvary, no cleansing, no conversion, no help in God. Do you know what? All that I have just said will be the last despairing wail of a Christ-rejecting sinner who has been launched bankrupt and alone into a lost eternity to wail out his torments forever beyond the peal of mercy and hope. No salvation in God any more for them. But that will not be said by God's child. For we are safe in the arms of Jesus. There is salvation for us in God. I was thinking today of Voltaire, Francois Marie Arouet, better known as Voltaire. He died in France way back in 1694, the 21st of November. He was 83 years of age. He died after a whole round of pleasure that had exhausted his strength. His spectral-like body, his wrinkled grin, had become a well-known sight in the glamorous courts right across Europe. He had entertained guests, many of them, thousands of them, with his liveliest talk all across that continent. He surrounded himself with people who had reverence for nothing apart from wit and pleasure and literary talent. My trade, said Voltaire, is to say what I think. And he obviously had a lot to think and therefore much to write. What he thought ran into 99 volumes of plays and poems and novels and articles and some 8,000 letters written to famous people. Censors banned his books, closed his plays, with the result that fashionable Paris thronged the opening nights and they gleefully memorized his most stinging lines. 14 years after his death, godless French revolutionaries took Voltaire's body and they brought it to Paris. They led him out in triumph from the ruins in the Bastille, and they made him their patron saint. A quarter of a million people pressed between lines of guards to pay homage to his remains. And then his body was given a state burial in the French Pantheon. His admirers tried to tone Voltaire down, kind of blunt the edge of his infidelity, but they did so when he was alive with very little success. When Voltaire had suffered a stroke and knew he hadn't long to live, he'd sent for a priest and sought reconciliation with the church. But reconciliation with Rome and reconciliation with God are two entirely different things. His infidel friends crowded the chambers to stop their idol from recanting his writings. But he cursed them and threw them out in the street. Then, hoping to push back further anguish in his soul, he prepared this written recantation and he signed it before witnesses. But it was no use. He had sinned away his day of grace and there was no help for him in God. For 2 long months leading up to his death, this wretched man was tormented by such agony of soul that people saw him gnash his teeth in a rage against God and man. At other times he'd be lying there and he'd whimper like a kitten. He'd turn his face to the wall and cry out, "I must die, abandoned of God and of man." As his end drew near, his spiritual condition became so fearful that his unbelieving friends who had fed off his blasphemies for years were terrified to come close to his bed to hear what he was saying. And yet they felt compelled to mount a guard around that home so that others could not find out how dreadful it was for an infidel to die. His nurse declared, and she was shattered by the experience, "Not for all the wealth of Europe would I ever see another infidel die." You see, the problem was there was no help for him in God. But David was no Voltaire. David was a man who knew God. Yes, he was a failing, stumbling, sinning saint. But he knew God and knew the salvation of God. And that's why we can leave this echo of the mocker's cry away in the distance and move on from verse 1 and 2 into verse 3 and 4. There we consider him not only David's triumph, but now David's trust. Verse 3 and verse 4. "There is no help for him in God," sneered David's enemies. But David knew that wasn't right. And so in 3:3 he speaks of his assurance in God. "But thou, O Lord, art a shield for me, my glory and the lifter up of mine head." He knew God, and so he appealed to God under the name of the Lord, capitals, Jehovah, the God who keeps his word, in other words, the God of covenant mercies, the God of continual provision. And David, in his triumph, is leaning ever so hard on this. His assurance was not based upon his circumstances. They were changing every second. But his assurance was based upon God's word. His assurance was not based upon his feelings. They were in and out and up and down and all over the place. But it was based, I repeat, on God's word, which would not move. God had pledged to David the throne, and God would not now give that throne for any length of time to his rebel son Absalom. The God who had put David on the throne once, David knew, he's able to put me back in it again. He is my shield. And here a shield means a buckler round about him, the kind of protection that would surround a man on every side of him, a shield around and above and beneath him. What a shield God is for us. And the fact David goes on here in Psalm 3 in the verse 3 to describe God in other ways as his glory, for example, and the lifter up of mine head, it all proves here he had such a confidence in God that he was looking beyond today to a day in the future when God would lift up his head again and he would be glorious through the glory of God. He saw himself by the hand of God in the future on the throne again, reinstated glory out of this old circumstance of shame here. So his assurance in God is wonderful to note in verse 3. But then his appeal to God, you'll see in 4. I cried unto the Lord with my voice, and he heard me out of his holy hill, Selah. Picture the totality of the circumstances. The enemies are lining up against him, and they're looking at him, and they're scoffing at him, and they're saying there's no help for him in God. But sinful man though he was, David says, I cried unto the Lord with my voice. I'm not listening to them. I'm lifting my voice heavenward, and he heard me out of his holy hill, Selah. Think about that. Over against the vengeful sneers of his enemies, David writes down a glorious fact. They're crying abuse. I'm crying in assurance, and God is answering my cry. And his voice rose away above the clamor and the din and the violence around him, and it pierced the skies, louder, stronger, more effectual than all the tumult around him. And when we are in the middle of trial, as David was, let me quote the words of the hymn writer as advice: go tell it to Jesus. He knoweth thy grief. Go tell it to Jesus. He'll send thee relief. Go gather the sunshine he sheds on the way. He'll lighten the burden. Go, weary one, pray. The trial, 1 and 2. The trust, 3 and 4. And then 5 through 8, his triumph. You can always trace that sequence in the experience of the child of God, because that's the way it works. Trial, trust, triumph. Look at the vision he got in verse 5 and in verse 6. I laid me down and slept. I awaked, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people that have set themselves against me round about. In the middle of torment, torture, treachery, David smiles up in the face of God, and he's more or less saying here, good night, Lord. As I go to sleep, I've done all I can. I have put as much distance as is possible between myself and the enemy. I have posted a guard. Now, thou, do sustain our cause, Lord. And with that, he goes to sleep. There were 10,000s of foes. Absalom had the numbers. But David had God. And that was his vision. And the vision that we need desperately to see again today: the largeness of our God. His vision. But that vision, little wonder we read then of David's victory in verse 7 and the verse 8. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for thou hast smitten all mine enemies upon the cheekbone. Thou hast broken the teeth of the ungodly. Salvation belongeth unto the Lord. Thy blessing is upon thy people, Selah. Here's a man who was wakened up to a new day with God. And he's invoking the words of Israel's old marching song, Arise, O Lord, the beginning of verse 7. And that's all he knew that God needed to do for him. And that's all God needs to do for us. In the darkness, in our distress over the darkness, in all of the depravity that is round about us, all God needs to do is arise. arise. Arise, O Lord. And this critical battle that he was going to have with Absalom and all the armed forces of Israel's people, that was still in the future at this point. But David had no doubt about how that was going to turn out. He talks as though the battle were already won. Thou hast smitten all mine enemies upon the cheekbone, verse 7. Thou hast, past tense, broken the teeth of the ungodly. David did not quite know it, but a little plan that he had put in motion was bearing fruit to a degree that he could scarcely have imagined. Because back in Jerusalem, in Absalom's council chamber, his advisors were gathered around him. And Ahithophel was an experienced man. And he told David what to do. Had David done it, or rather Absalom told Absalom what to do, had Absalom done it, David would have been history. Ahithophel's advice was good. But there was a man in there, Hushai. We read about him at the end of 2 Samuel 15, and he was a loyal friend of David. And David said, go back, Hushai, join yourself to the priests that are going back to the city of Jerusalem, become part of Absalom's council chamber, his inner counselors, and then threw into disarray the council of Ahithophel. David feared the counsel of that man, so he sent in Hushai the Archite, and he was David's secret agent, you could call him, in the palace. And Absalom is listening to Hushai. David's plan was being played out. David used means, as we should too. But he totally trusted in God. And God is already in full control. Ye fearful saints, William Cooper wrote, fresh courage take. The clouds ye so much dread are big with mercy and shall fall in blessing on your head. David had one more word. Sums up the psalm. Verse 8, salvation is of the Lord. Thy blessing is upon thy people, Selah. There, pause and ponder that. What do you think of that? Salvation is of the Lord. It's not the personal property of some preacher or a priest or a pope. It is only of the Lord. Take one example in history. King Henry II, first of the Plantagenets, father of Richard the Lionheart, who was the greatest of all English kings. Henry had appointed his friend Thomas a Becket to be the Archbishop of Canterbury, and he hoped that he would find in Thomas a Becket an ally against Rome. But Becket swung the other way, and he flung the weight of his office against the king, and then as a result of a chance word, Becket was murdered by Henry's aides, and the king had to face the wrath of the Pope. The Pope waded into the situation, placed all of England under interdict. A terrible fate in those far off days. People believed then salvation is off the Pope. The bishops of England donned the robes of mourning usually reserved for Good Friday, and they entered their churches to the tolling of the funeral bells. Shrines and crucifixes were covered. The relics of saints were removed. The water was taken out of the place. The wafer solemnly burned. Throughout the land, the bishops of Rome declared England to be under the ban of the church. Torches and candles were extinguished. England was plunged into the dark, literally. There could be no burying. There could be no marrying. There was no salvation for any soul in England. The church had withdrawn its light, and that fear of interdict settled in every home and every heart. Before long, Henry II, strong though he was, buckled. He bowed. He kissed the stones where Thomas a Becket had fallen. He went to the martyr's crypt and he lay all night before the tomb. He bared his royal back to the lash, and he allowed each high officer of Canterbury to smite him 5 times, and each of the monks to come in and smite him 3 times each. So he had hundreds of lashes on his back by the time it was over, and he lay bruised and broken and bleeding in silence before the martyr's tomb. When he struggled to his feet, he walked across Canterbury in his bare feet. And he did all of that to persuade the Pope to relent. But it was all one giant fraud. Had Henry II read his Bible, had he known God half as well as David knew him, he would have known this simple, satisfying, energizing, assuring truth: salvation is of the Lord. And he'd have read the word Selah that comes after it there. What do you think of that? Meditate on this. Salvation is of the Lord. I've no idea what Joab might have thought of it all when David looked up from reading this hymn. But what Joab thought is of no consequence, if he thought anything at all. What David thought is the important thing, and we know what he thought. As we close, do you see Jesus in this psalm? Her many enemies, multitudes of them, our Lord Jesus had. The world hated him, John 7:7. They taunted him at the cross, and they taunted him effectively like this, Matthew 27:43. There is no salvation for him in God. He cried to his Father as the world reviled him. His Father heard him. He predicted the ruin of his enemies. And glory came to him, and blessing flowed upon his people as a result. Salvation is of the Lord. Thy blessing is upon thy people. Selah. Here we have what Bonner, we mentioned him at the beginning, I mentioned him at the end. Here we have, in this psalm, the safety of the righteous when surrounded by his enemies. The safety of the righteous when surrounded by his enemies. Let's pray.